On this edition of Free Culture Radio, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step as Ireland looks at the decriminalization of people who use drugs. Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. In 2023, the government of the Republic of Ireland formed a Citizens' Assembly on Drugs Use to, quote, consider the legislative policy and operational changes Ireland could make to significantly reduce the harmful impacts of illicit drugs on individuals, families, communities, and wider Irish society, end quote. The Citizens' Assembly published its report and recommendations in January of this year. Then in March, the Oireachtas, which is the national parliament of the Republic of Ireland, established a joint committee on drugs use to consider and respond to the Assembly's recommendations. The joint committee has been holding a series of discussions on the topic of decriminalization, depenalization, diversion, and legalization of drugs. They've had some fascinating meetings, really powerful testimony. On today's show, we're going to hear from a few of the witnesses from the July 11th meeting. First up is Antonio Leitao da Silva, superintendent of the Public Security Police and commander of the Municipal Police of Porto, Portugal.
When I was invited for this meeting, I made a kind of retrospective analysis about the experience in Portugal. As you know, we decriminalized the drug use in 2001, and if we compare the rates of drug use and drug overdoses in the past and now, we have an incredibly low number if we compare the numbers before 2001, even though that the numbers are increasing now again. And I think there is an European tendency of the usage of other synthetic drugs and the massive use of cocaine as well. But the experience that we have, it's very promising, I have to say. Even though that with the Troika period in 2010 and 2011, we had a huge step back because one of our institutes were dismantled due to the lack of funding, and we had a step back in the again. And I think one of the main questions that you probably want to ask me is what is the police role in this new scenario? Well, it's not new because we have been experiencing this for the last 23 years. One of the things that I would like to emphasize, and I did that in my keynotes that I sent to you previously, it's for the police, it's kind of a challenge in the change of the mindsets for the drug user not being considered as a criminal, but much more a problem of social with a social impact. And I think that this challenge for the police, it takes years to be settled. It's not an easy job, definitely. And in a very police perspective, I have to say that this new legislation, first of all, is treating individuals in a much more combined perspective of human rights other than just criminal subjects. That's, I think, is the most important thing. Secondly, in terms of public health, I think the outcomes are enormous. First of all, we are treating them equally, and especially in terms of public health system, we are able to get them back in track to the system again. That means we have a decreased number of infections, comorbidities, diseases as well, and we have the numbers that we have are quite good, even though that the numbers are increasing right now. One of the things in a very police perspective, it's not easy for a police officer, and I remember in 2001, just we are not electric switches, you know, you cannot just change the police mindset in 2001 and have a completely different police approach. I think this required probably a police generation to get settled. That means I've been working in this for 36 years. One of these days I'm about to retire, but I think it was quite a long period of adaptation to see these individuals not as criminals. I'm not saying that they don't have a criminal interest for the police job. They have. But we have to consider that these individuals are much more a social problem than a police problem. I have to admit that for all of these years, and we've been working very closely, for example, with the drug consumption room that was opened 2 years ago in Porto, and we keep this strong connection with the world of drug users. But they are respecting us as police officers as well, but not with its criminal, in a criminal perspective. I've been a little bit skeptical about what is going to be the future with this huge amount of drugs that are coming to Europe. And I think the effort that has to be done in a very repression perspective has to increase, especially with the amount of drugs that are coming from South America and with the new opioid synthetic drugs as well. But starting from the beginning, and that's what I would like to emphasize, it's going to take time. If your decision is to decriminalize drugs, in Portugal we have decriminalized, but we didn't depenalize the drugs. It's not a crime, but there is still a sanction. Obviously, this sanction is very mild, and in most of the cases are not applicable. But if your path going through decriminalization in a very police perspective, it's going to take quite a long amount of time to get the police mindset that adjusts to this new reality.
That was Antonio Leitão da Silva, superintendent of the Public Security Police and commander of the Municipal Police of Porto, Portugal, making his opening statement before the Joint Committee on Drugs Use of Ireland's Oireachtas on July 11th. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear from Dr. Cian Ócrathúr, assistant professor in criminal justice at Maynooth University's School of Law and Criminology.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak with the committee as it undertakes potentially generationally significant legislative work in the area of drugs policy. My name is Dr. Cian Ócrathúr. I'm a graduate in law from Trinity College Dublin and the University of Oxford. I also hold a doctorate in criminology from the University of Oxford, where I undertook ethnographic research on policing in England. I'm currently assistant professor in criminal justice at Maynooth University School of Law and Criminology, where I lecture on criminal law and policing. My research specialisms lie in the area of criminal law and policing, with a particular focus on police powers, governance, accountability, and legitimacy. I speak to the committee today not just as a researcher of these areas. I'm also one of a handful of criminal justice scholars with direct personal experience of the criminal justice system. Before attending university and embarking on my academic life, I worked as a stonemason in the west of Ireland, where I'm from. During this time, I was also engaged in the cultivation of cannabis plants for sale and supply. I was arrested in March 2009 and pleaded guilty in December 2010 to Section 15A of the Misuse of Drugs Act 1977. I was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment, but this was suspended in its entirety. I was a user and supplier of prohibited drugs and therefore engaged in activities that Irish politicians, police, courts and news media routinely characterise as evil. Since the enactment of the Misuse of Drugs Act 1977, Ireland has treated the use, whether problematic or otherwise, and sale and supply of certain substances as serious criminal offences. The 1977 Act was passed to ratify the UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs, which mandated signatory states like Ireland to pursue a criminal justice-led response to drug use and drug markets. The UN Single Convention was largely drafted and promulgated by the United States of America. US President Richard Nixon declared the war on drugs in 1971, largely for domestic political reasons. And since then, the US has pushed to globalize this war through, among other efforts, the UN's narcotics treaties. Ireland did not declare the war on drugs. However, it has over the last 50 years sought diligently and often thoughtlessly to pursue its logics and practices. It is easy to think that drugs are new and that criminal prohibition was always the norm. In truth, many substances now prohibited, such as cocaine and heroin, were at one time lawfully available to people in Ireland. Some substances, such as cannabis, have been present in Ireland for at least a millennium. Historically, then, criminal prohibition is the aberration. In this opening statement, I wish to make some essential points regarding the nature and purpose of criminal offences and the consequences of drug policing practices. Criminal offences are, at their core, designed to impose stigma. We cannot remove the stigma around conduct if we maintain criminal offences in relation to that conduct. Criminal offences criminalise people, not substances. You cannot criminalise drugs in the abstract. Criminal offences apply to people only. We cannot decriminalise use of a substance while criminalising the substance. The people who are subject to criminalisation are, therefore, who we need to talk about. Relatedly, any effort to decriminalise drug use in Ireland must begin by repealing Section 3 of the Misuse of Drugs Act 1977. Any measure short of this will maintain Garda and court discretion, which will lead to continued criminalisation and punishment of drug users. Decriminalisation or legalisation does not equate to state endorsement or normalisation of an activity. The decriminalisation of suicide in 1993 does not constitute state endorsement or normalisation of suicide. Indeed, the state can legally permit conduct while actively and often successfully dissuading and discouraging it through other legal and policy measures. Ireland's current law and policy governing tobacco is an excellent illustration of this. The criminal justice response mandated by the 1977 Act is the most intrusive, coercive and punitive response the state could have adopted in relation to drug use. The exceptionally intrusive powers granted to police to pursue the war on drugs are themselves the cause of significant harm to communities that the state claims to protect and have serious constitutional and human rights implications. I argue that drugs policing practices are fundamentally at variance with the state's commitment to human rights-based policing and its stated desire to police by consent. Criminal prohibition of drug use is corrosive to policing itself and police community relations. Intelligence gathering tactics, often of questionable value, seeks to instrumentalise drug users by threatening them with criminal convictions if they do not inform. Stop and search practices for drugs are by their nature often degrading and dehumanising for those subject to them, especially as most subjects are innocent of any offence. In every country where this happens, excessive use of stop and search practices, overwhelmingly deployed against socioeconomically or ethnically marginalised groups, poison police community relations. With those points in mind, I look forward to assisting the committee in its deliberations.
That was Dr. Cian Ócrathóir, Assistant Professor in Criminal Justice at Maynooth University, making his opening statement before the Joint Committee on Drugs Use of Ireland's Oireachtas on July 11th. And now here's Nick Glynn, a former UK police officer and specialist on police reform at the Open Society Foundation.
My name's Nick Glynn. For the last 8 years, I've led work on police accountability and reform in the United Kingdom and across Western Europe at Open Society Foundations, which is a global human rights organisation. I'm a board member of the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board for the Police Race Action Plan, leading on use of police powers. I'm a retired senior police officer, having served for 30 years in a variety of operational and management roles. I was the College of Policing lead for Stop and Search from 2012 to 2016 and led reforms to Stop and Search across England and Wales. I'm a former vice president of the National Black Police Association. I have a law degree and a master's in applied criminology from Cambridge University. My interest in drug policy flows from my policing experiences and also my personal experiences of the ways in which police powers that emanate from the war on drugs, the so-called war on drugs, impact people, and notably the disproportionate effect on black people and other people of colour. I've listened to the previous two statements, actually, and especially the last one. I really agree with every word of it. I believe that the so-called war on drugs is built upon race and class issues, and that from that perspective, it's been successful. The war on drugs is often called a disaster, and it's been a failure, but actually, my view is it was designed to put certain communities down, to criminalise them, and to exacerbate the structural inequalities that already exist in society. The so-called war on drugs ignores the evidence from academics and from history that people have always used substances, and I don't make the distinction between drugs and substances, actually. People have always used substances, that they are still doing so and that they always will. On that basis, the path, and a tricky one, I understand that, towards decriminalisation and legalisation of drugs, with all of the challenges and checks and balances needed along that route, is needed urgently to stop the harms that are caused by prohibition, because it's prohibition that causes the harms, not really the drugs themselves. Overdose deaths, violence, criminalisation, addiction, and many other harms besides can be avoided if a new approach to substance use is taken. Continuing in the futile quest of ridding society of drugs is the definition of madness. Carrying on doing the same things over and over again since 1977 in Ireland, since 1971 in England and Wales, and expecting different results is madness. I've seen firsthand how police officers under the Misuse of Drugs Act are used, abused, and misused by police officers. Changing drug policy could be transformational for police, for communities, and for community safety if the police didn't spend so much of its time and resources and energy fighting this futile, unwinnable war. Trust and confidence in policing across the piece, but in the UK in particular at the moment, is at an all-time low, and it's declining. One of the most contentious police powers is stop and search. Between 60 and 70% of stops and searches are for drugs, not for weapons, and these have consistently low fine rates. If policing was empowered to stop wasting time and resources trying to find tiny bits of cannabis, officers could use their time more productively detecting and preventing violent crime and other crimes that have a direct impact on communities. Starting on the path towards decriminalisation and legalisation, with cannabis the obvious first choice, will, in my view, take drug supply and demand out of unregulated markets where criminal interests outweigh a desire to keep people safe. Allow drug issues to be dealt with as a health and education matter, rather than a matter for the criminal law. Ensure that people who need help with addiction receive such help, and also notably that the vast majority of people who use drugs don't have any problems with addiction whatsoever. It will acknowledge that people who use drugs for pleasure, and no amount of criminal sanctions have or will prevent this. It will free up police resources and or enable resources to be diverted to alternative community safety solutions that have never been provided the opportunity or resources to thrive and succeed. It could provide potential tax revenue and ensure that safe supply is available so as to avoid the most serious harms created by prohibition.
That was Nick Glynn, a former UK police officer and specialist on police reform at the Open Society Foundation, making his opening statement before the Joint Committee on Drugs Use of Ireland's Oireachtas on July 11th. The committee has been holding a series of meetings to discuss decriminalization, depenalization, diversion, and legalization of drugs. We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more from that discussion on decriminalization, depenalization, diversion, and legalization of drugs that was held July 11th by the Irish National Parliament's Joint Committee on Drugs Use. Members of the committee were able to ask questions of the witnesses. Here's Deputy Mark Ward questioning Mark Glynn and Dr. Cian O'Crahour.
We do know the war on drugs is not working, and having this committee here is proof that it's not working, because if it was working, we wouldn't be any need for any of us to be here today. And the Citizens' Assembly was the same reason for that as well. I was interested in what you were saying in relation to the race and class on the war on drugs, and they're going from an area of disadvantage, and stop and search was something that I grew up with. Like, just even going to shopping, you'd be stopped and searched. Going football training, you'd be stopped and searched. If you're with more than one person walking on the road, you were stopped and searched. There wasn't a rhyme or reason in that. So my first question is to Mr. Glynn, basically on that. I think there's going to have to be, for that to change, there's going to have to be a cultural shift in the guards over here. So my fear is that the guards could look at other reasons to stop and search people from disadvantaged areas for different backgrounds in relation to, for example, they could use an increase in knife crime for a reason to stop and search. Do you see that as an issue going forward? Do you see that cultural change needed in Garda Síochána to stop that stop and search, basically? Or how would you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't have a lot of experience of the Guards, but I do of the Metropolitan Police in the UK, and I've said before that they're addicted to Stop and Serve. So I think there is a challenge there, yes, that there is a cultural shift needed. And indeed, the work that I did in the early sort of 2012-2013, where policing in England and Wales saw a massive reduction in Stop and Serve, was because of a political drive to say, these powers are intrusive. They actually can create and drive a wedge between young people and, you know, the future population and police authority. And so those powers, whilst some of them are still necessary, should be used sparingly, and they should only be used when necessary and when there's a legal basis for doing so. And the experience that you just share there of, you know, from your youth, I guess, maybe some people's first experience of the policing is being stop and searched. It shouldn't be that way. So I think there is a need, if decriminalisation is to be the next step, then that is a transition that the police need to buy into themselves, actually. And I think one of the ways that can happen is for them to see the advantages of decriminalisation, giving them time and opportunity to focus on other things that are more important and that are closer to why they are here, which is the protection of life and property. Stop and search powers themselves, one of the stop and search powers in the UK is under question at the moment, Section 60, which is a suspicionless stop and search, which has been massively abused and misused by the police. And so scrutiny and oversight of these powers is really important, and there is a challenge indeed for policing to accept that they may not be able to stop everybody in the street just when they want to, because they don't have the legal power and right to do so. And that's a difficult conundrum for them to accept sometimes.
Okay, thank you. And I have a question for Kane then as well. Just we heard earlier on Deputy Stanton talking about unintended consequences that happened in British Columbia with the amount of the increase in public drug consumption and the impact that was having on the well-being and wider society. Is there any other unintended consequences that we should be concerned about in both a positive and a negative way, do you think, in relation to, say, maybe move to decriminalisation in this state?
So I think managing public expectations is really important, because there is a risk of backlash, and making politicians anxious about decisions, as you saw in the Oregon experience. There's been an effort for the elected representatives to undo a popular vote, which I think is a really good example of the kinds of unintended consequences or risks that you should be very conscious of. So I think, maintaining or encouraging local authorities to prohibit public consumption is a smart way, but okay. Not just that. I would say, just on your question for Nick, it's related to this, is around stop and search powers. So a big problem we're going to have in Ireland, so in the UK, well, specifically England and Wales, for very specific historical reasons, no less the fallout from the murder of Stephen Lawrence and other things. They have a very sophisticated conversation at a political level about stop and search powers, about police powers in general, that just does not exist here. Politicians, maybe you're one of the few who maybe would raise this as an issue. There is no scrutiny or oversight of An Garda Síochána in terms of their use of powers. They do not publicise, if they collect data at all about how they use these powers, they don't publicise it. My understanding is they do not gather data. So we have no idea what An Garda Síochána are currently doing with their stop and search powers. My suspicion, if we look to Scotland, which the rates of stop and search power use were far, far higher in Scotland than they were in England and Wales. I suspect Ireland is closer to Scotland than it is to England and Wales, because, as Nick said, if you do not have oversight, political oversight, and oversight from the oversight mechanisms like the policing authority. If you do not have oversight, these powers will end up being overused. They will, especially if there isn't a political commitment. If there isn't a political commitment, and I say police are political in their own way, if they are not committed, police leaders are not committed to reducing excessive use of stop and search power, and there is no soundings from An Garda Síochána, there's never been any soundings, that there's a desire to reduce their use of these powers in particular communities, then one of the consequences that might be missed in this effort would be an effort to engage with that. Yeah, police community relations, particularly the most marginalised communities, because these powers are not being used in Ranelagh and Donnybrook. These powers are overwhelmingly being used to target marginalised communities. And I think that conversation needs to be had as part of this.
And I don't know if I was going to answer this, and I know we've got a brief time left, just because we're looks like we're moving to the introduction of body-worn cameras over here for the guards. Would that be a way of kind of limiting stop and search, that the guards would have to have a reason to stop and search and have to prove why they were talking to somebody?
So Nick might be able to comment on this. My understanding is it doesn't have a massive impact. Okay. I don't have a massive problem with the introduction of body-worn cameras, but it will be at the discretion of the guard whether they turn it off on or not.
Yeah. If we go to bring in Mr. Clinton, just to give him a bit of time. Yeah. Thanks.
You just want me? Yeah, the important question, I don't think, is scrutiny and oversight. You know, what are police officers doing with those stop and search powers? When are they using them? Who are they using them on? So all of that data, the police have that data, or they certainly have the ability to collect that data, and it should be shared publicly, because they should have nothing to hide about how they use those powers. Credit to the police in England and Wales that much of that data is collected and shared publicly. That's a good way of starting an effective conversation with the public as well as with police leaders around scrutiny and oversight of stop and search powers. Body-worn cameras, they are here to stay. I don't think we can sort of turn the clock back on those. And they have a function in scrutiny and oversight. But there's lots of barriers actually to access to the body-worn footage, those stop and search powers have been used, whether the camera's been activated, whether it's activated early enough before the interaction starts. So there's a lot of detailed work needs doing there to make body-worn cameras part of an effective tool around scrutiny and oversight of police powers.
That was Deputy Mark Ward questioning Mark Glynn and Dr. Cian O'Cruaghaire at a meeting on July 11th of the Irish National Parliament's Joint Committee on Drugs Use. At the end of this meeting, the Joint Committee adjourned for the rest of summer to resume again in September. For now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. And you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Links are at the website kboo.fm/freeculture. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel in Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!